there's birds tweeting and stuff. And that hammer.
I can't hear any birds tweeting.
And that hammer you're taking to the birds.
The hammer that I'm enforcing swift avian justice with. We needed you during lockdown. You kept us going anyway, but those days are over.
Huh? It's the old red kite mallet.
Yeah.
Numbers are up.
Numbers are up.
Time to take the edge off.
Joking aside, there are too many red kites.
Are those the ones where you go, oh, look, it's a noble eagle, a wondrous yeah, it's the, a wondrous falcon.
It turns out it's a red kite, I think.
It's another effing red kite. They're not majestic. They're not wonderful. Stop looking at it. They don't count. Is it one of those?
Well, sort of, yeah. They used to be majestic and wonderful because being majestic and wonderful just means rare, right?
Yeah.
In the same way that if you'd never seen an ant before and you came across it, you'd think it was majestic and wonderful.
Okay.
There used to be barely any red kites at all left in the UK. And if you saw one, it was absolutely amazing. And then there was this huge effort to conserve them and reintroduce them and bring them back. And certainly in parts of the country, i.e. Mid Wales, the M4 corridor, they are absolutely everywhere. And as a result, I think they're no longer special.
They're no longer special. Which then brings in, and this is the cycle of life, is it then brings in the culling years.
The hammer years.
The hammer years where culling is encouraged.
So where people up and down the country are hurling hammers into the sky all the livelong day.
That's right.
Volley upon volley of hammers.
And you can actually see flocks of hammers sort of arcing across the sky. It's actually quite
beautiful. Oh, it's a beautiful sight. You catch it at dawn.
When the light catches it, yeah. It's really quite
lifting. Oh, the golden hour. A nation united, finally.
Yeah.
We just needed a common foe. That's what it was. It's been divided for so long.
And then, of course, that supplies the economy. That helps the economy.
The hammer industry. Yeah. I mean, half my family's working in the hammer industry these days.
And, of course, you need...
It's keeping us afloat.
What do you make a hammer with? Slightly smaller hammer. So, obviously, the slightly smaller hammers are selling really well. They need those in the hammer factories. So you've got hammers. Obviously, those are made by tiny hammers. Or you can carry on.
Of course, but of course... leading us to the question, how did they make the first hammer? Nobody knows that, do they? Because how is it hammered into shape?
And that's what's keeping our education system alive right now. Is
that question?
Children are pondering that question in great depth. Get a hive brain on it.
But no, that thing with the red kite, that's the same thing. Because I've had that as a city lad. I go to the country. It doesn't take much to impress me. So I'll quite often say things like, oh, that's a fabulous red kite. No, that's a fabulous bird of prey. No, it's just a red kite.
Yeah.
That's some fabulous sort of swamp creature. No, that's our head teacher.
Well, you've joined a school, have you?
Back to square one.
I do talk.
You're just starting again.
You're really over that B in A-level art, Henry?
Don't bring it up. My seriously, it's not funny. Art's subjective. You can't actually judge it. In fact, Picasso probably would have got a B or even worse. Well, actually, that's the problem. He would have got worse. I didn't get a D. If I got a D, I could have claimed I was actually a great artist. It wasn't understood by the times. B just means, B stands for banal, essentially, doesn't it? Banal. Boring, beverage, mediocre. Yeah. This work is, on the one hand, it's not a realistic portrayal of a jug, but also, nor is it a bad enough portrayal of a jug to foment societal change.
Is that your take on Picasso, that he was so bad that he became...
Also that he was always trying to paint jugs.
I think that is what happened with Picasso. He was just desperately, desperately trying to create a realistic human face. That was all he ever wanted to do.
What was Guernica meant to be?
Well, like most great works of art, what he was aspiring to do was to portray a bunch of dogs playing snooker.
Because that's where the money is.
That's where the money is. He was a commercial artist. You've got to make ends meet. You've got to draw dogs playing snooker.
Yeah.
So you can see the one that they've interpreted as a sort of screaming bull to represent the Spanish, you know, the Spanish identity going through the torture of civil war. No, that's actually just supposed to be a pug trying to do a snooker.
Trying to get a tricky black.
Trying to use the spider. So I'll go to the country. Quite often I'll be over-impressed by stuff. Because this is what happens. I've got the classic Londoner city boy attitude to the country, which is visit it for about a day and a half.
Get terrified by a cow.
Yeah, but before that, I'll get terrified by a cow. But before that, there'll be a moment where it's like I'm sort of high. It's like I'm just wandering around Glastonbury, you know, spangled up. I'm like, oh, this is so wonderful. Look at the It's so beautiful. It's so amazing. I could live here. I could 100% live here. And
this is all of you from the M4, isn't it, so far?
From the M4. And this is so stunning.
Look at these verges, these stunning verges.
Is that natural? The verge, does that happen by itself? The verge, it's extraordinary. And these miniature shopping centres that have sprung up. Yeah, so I'll be over-impressed. And then people will point out that what I'm looking at isn't impressive. This actually used to happen to me as a kid. The red kite equivalent, I see it's from my mum, was I'd go, oh, look, it's a lovely butterfly. Look, Mum, it's a beautiful butterfly. And she'd go, no, it's not, Henry. It's a cabbage white.
It's a dead sparrow.
It's a dead sparrow.
Put it down. Put it down, Henry.
Fundamentally, there's no reason why a cabbage white is less or more. I mean, it is just the most boring looking one because it's just white. It's like one that hasn't been painted yet, isn't it? But all animals, there's a weird continuum of rareness that makes them more exciting. Like, so I recently saw an osprey.
Very good.
But there are only a handful of ospreys in the UK. Well, certainly Wales, there's like 10 or something.
I've just Googled it. It's a form of leather bag, sort of handy day bag. It's a form of day bag.
And to watch one of those arcing through the air is incredible.
It's extraordinary.
As it's being thrown at a red kite.
Yeah. It's top flap billowing so you can see the handy extra pockets it's got on the inside.
The number of hammers you can pack in an osprey these days.
It's one of the few birds of prey with a laptop pouch. Yeah. Let's turn on the bean machine.
Yes, please.
This week's topic, as sent in by Megan from Bremen.
Hello, Megan.
Is cults.
Ooh. You two got me into quite a good cult pod quite recently.
Oh, the Very British Cult, is that what it's called?
Yeah, the Lighthouse thing.
Yeah, that was good. That's an official Three Bean recommendation. Ding!
Oh. That's five hot beans.
It's rare that we give five hot beans to another
Very
podcast.
Very rare to get five hot beans to another podcast.
But it was good. It was on BBC Sounds. It's called A Very British Cult.
And it's definitely not, I'm sorry, but it's a soggy chickpea. Wah, 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 wah.
Is there anything between five hot beans and soggy chickpea? For example, three hot beans and two soggy chickpeas.
There are, you know, the wonderful plethora, the teeming life that is the... You know, the current global podcast scene, which, look, can I just say, just sick of this stuff. We did not start this, guys. do you know what I mean? Come on. Yeah.
I had a moment this week that I shared with you on WhatsApp where we got into the top 12, which means you're kind of on the front screen of the iTunes comedy chart. And I don't look at the it every day to see where we are.
Of course you don't.
No.
I mean,
no.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah. Just on the off chance that you might be able to brag in the middle of an episode about.
Nah, you wouldn't do that. Nah. It's simply not you to do that, is it?
No.
So the fact that, I mean, how on earth? How on earth did you find yourself in a situation where you're looking at that data, and that you're able to gather that data? How did that happen?
Is he normally straight out of the studio after recording, aren't you? Off into the Brecon Beacons on your foldy bike, aren't you? That's what you're normally...
Yeah.
Mike, given their proper name, they're now called the Banai Brecaniog.
Of course.
Yeah. And also, given its proper name, it's a Hyundai i10.
Foldable. Fully foldable.
It's the first fully foldable Hyundai i10. Extraordinary technology. They haven't mastered it yet. It's currently bigger. It takes up more space, doesn't it, in its folded up form, because obviously...
Yeah, they fold out for some reason.
It folds out.
And it's heavier as well in the folded form.
That's
as well.
Right, yeah. So yeah. You fold it out, and obviously that exposes all the engine parts, doesn't it? All the very, very hot.
Fantastically cumbersome pieces.
Hugely dangerous and hugely cumbersome. Red hot, isn't it? The temperature of the inside of a Hyundai is...
Red, all the red hot liquids are leaking.
They're all leaking out. Spraying.
can't stop the wheel spinning, can you? When you've folded it out, either the wheels
they're spinning, but they've got nothing to bite on, so they're spinning without bite. So it's angry spinning, isn't it? From those tire treads.
Yeah.
But of course, that's what happens when you are a Hyundai Premium Club member, isn't it? You get to test the beta stuff, don't you?
And public ambassador. Thanks to the guys at Hyundai. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, why are we talking about that?
Because that's what you would normally be doing rather than
sat in the dark
in your little garret staring at a computer screen, Googling yourself or looking at where you're charting this week.
The idea of Ben poring over that kind of information in some detail is absolutely absurd. There's no way it happens. I'm sorry.
And it's certainly not true that my other podcast, Beef and Dairy Network, is languishing near the bottom, out of the top 100 now and sort of deep into the 200s. That's not happening.
That's not happening. And B, if it is happening, you don't know it's happening because you're simply not interested in that kind of data.
And that wouldn't be possible anyway because you slave over that one. That involves a huge amount of work, the soundscaping, the editing, the writing. There are performers to recruit and direct rather than, you know, just a couple of guys talking
a lot of shit.
Toss.
But that wouldn't be
more popular than something you've poured blood, sweat and tears into.
Bit close to the bone here, Mike.
That's quite the point. The fact is, it's more cool, isn't it, though? To be honest,
to be unpopular, yeah.
Yeah. it's more cool because that's, you know, that's got a dedicated following of people that absolutely love it. Whereas this
a cult following, could you say?
Ooh, like
on topic.
Basically, the three bean salad, in terms of Ben's podcast output, three bean salad is Coldplay. Ben is the drummer in Coldplay, isn't he?
and his solo output.
Have you heard the drummer in Coldplay's got a new album? No, I haven't.
Just drums.
It's just drums.
And his second album is just sticks. That's it.
It's quite fun to work out which Coldplay song he's playing, actually. Oh, is that Yellow? Oh, there's no way of knowing.
I don't know. I think it's just the drum stool from Yellow. I can't.
But you know, I think the better analogy is Coldplay. I think Three Bean Salad for Ben is when Anthony Hopkins turns up in a sci-fi. Essentially it's paying the bills. But you got to do them. It turns up. You say yes. You do it. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's another three beans out. I'll do it. But the project he really cares about, essentially, your Howard's End,
right,
is the Beef and Dairy Network, isn't it?
Yeah, but Howard's End was also really popular. It's more like what Anthony Hopkins really cares about is the small painted figurines he makes and tries to sell on a website. People don't even know about it.
He absolutely cannot shift.
Because he accidentally hasn't managed to get the website up online yet, and he doesn't know that. He's literally just looking at a screen on his laptop. He thinks it's online. It isn't. You can't find it anywhere. It's completely off-grid.
It's just a JPEG made by his nephew to keep him quiet.
I don't even know what these things are. He says it's a JPEG. Is that right? I think pegs are things you hang things up with. I don't know. But he... That's a terrible impression, that.
Awful.
Also, he is one of the worst. But also, that was actually how he got the performance how he got his performance so good in Silence of the Lambs. That blood curdling sort of chill is because he's thinking, he channeled how angry he is about how few figurines he's selling. So he'd think about it. He'd have a quick look at the figurine data from the printout.
Famously, the director, just before those scenes where he needed to really channel it, would spit into his face, "Your figurines are shit." Action.
Action.
Clarice.
Hopkins is attacking the glass. He's got too angry. Hopkins, rein it in. He's trying to eat the glass. He's trying to eat his way through to get Jodie Foster the fuck out of here. He's gone dangerous. Get Jodie Foster out. This is not a drill. Get her out. Hopkins is broken.
That glass cube was there because of the actor Anthony Hopkins. It was nothing to do with the character.
No. Well, sometimes they'd show him, to get him really angry, they'd show him a figurine that Ian McKellen had painted in 15 minutes and sold for £10,000. And that would
miles
really...
better.
That one doesn't count. It was for charity. Of course people were paid £1,000 for charity. And I don't do space orcs anyway. Fuck you, McKellen.
So that's true of the glass enclosure. Obviously, they thought it was see-through, so it wouldn't show up on film. That was the idea.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, same go. You know the outfit he was wearing where he's got the... the hockey mask, the hockey mask, and he's attached to a trolley.
Yeah, that's his figurine painting muzzle. That's his figurine. So he doesn't drop nose hairs onto the the hard acrylic paints. Just just when they're tacky. They're an absolute disaster. You're back to square one.
Because obviously he was working on the figurines. As soon as there was a cut, he was back in his trailer working figurines. He'd get straight into the air. That's all he cared about. Shifting his figurines, so he'd be in the outfit. And there's no way McKellen bothers with the mask. He doesn't have the level of perfectionism I have, but the public don't understand anything. The love I've put into this, he's a dwarf. He's a battle dwarf. He's a battle dwarf. I know how, can I say battle dwarf? I know how you feel. I know how you bloody feel.
And of course, when Hopkins was then given an Oscar for that performance, he was essentially being given a figurine made by someone else. He was absolutely livid.
Absolutely livid.
And a dog shit to a penny machine made figurine.
Which everyone was very excited about. I couldn't.
This is one colour. It's not even painted.
Couldn't have been more angry.
He's won two, I think. Poor man.
Has he?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a thumb in the eye, isn't it?
So what's he won them for?
He won them for Silence of the Lambs. And for, I think, The Father?
Oh, that was quite
Did
recent,
he win an Oscar for that?
Well, if he didn't, he shouldn't have done it.
He seems to have made the bold decision move, which is to simply not die and just keep going. And he simply just becomes older, sort of slightly smaller and rounder and more sort of whittled or kind of...
Transportable.
Or transportable. He's becoming more pebble-like, as we've discussed before. Eventually time and erosion turns everything into pebbles. He's becoming quite rounded.
5 years' time, you'll be able to sling him, won't you?
Skim him across a mill pond. Could... The weird thing about Hopkins is he has actually got a passion, hasn't he, that isn't what everyone knows him for. So he does paintings,
Does he?
He's one of those people that thinks of himself primarily as a painter, I think. Which is a classic, really good actor thing.
Acting's just the day job.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You get to a level of fame where you can do the thing you actually want to do, which is never the thing you're actually doing. Mm. You know, Mike is a podcaster in this respect, but dreams of being a banjo player. That's how he sees himself.
I see myself as the heir to Earl Scruggs, really. A West Country Earl Scruggs.
Mike, I know we don't often do this, but we've had a lot of emails about Earl Scruggs.
Have you?
Can I,
Have we? Have we?
Well, it's for you.
Oh, all right.
What is Earl Scruggs?
Well, here we go. It's a rare... This is such a significant bollocking. It's happening outside of the email section.
Rogue bollock.
Oh, right, okay.
A bollock is through the perimeter. Repeat. A bollock is through... A bollock has breached the perimeter.
Accessing listener bollocking. Bollocking loading. Bollocking loaded.
Right, we've had three emails about this very topic. I'm going to read one of them out, and you can choose which one. Do you want subject title Banjo Bollock from James?
Okay.
Do you want Xavier's Banjo Bollock Bonanza?
Oh, golly.
I like the way there's some great branding happening with these bollocks, by the way.
They've put the work in, haven't they? What's number three?
Number three is from Bug, and that's simply banjo, lowercase, uppercase, bollocking.
Well, lovely.
Okay.
I'd love to get a creative team to sit around and just come up with some logos and some visual ideas for this stuff. Do you think they've all got like really nice starting points? They're playing with font, they're playing with you know, capitalization, and I love it. Great stuff. Yeah, which one's grabbing you, Mike?
Oh, I feel nervous. I feel like I'm going to yank off the plaster. I'm going to go for the bonanza.
Banjo bollock bonanza. It had to
it's
be
going hard.
So Xavier from Glasgow writes, "Dear Beans, I thought Mike to be a knowledgeable fellow when it comes to banjo styles." but after hearing him speak of a Scruggs-style claw hammer in your tea episode, it appears it isn't so.
Oh, dear.
As Henry will be delighted to hear, claw hammer is practiced by the picking hand moving freely over the strings with the index and middle fingers curved into the shape of a hammer's back claw. Oh. Hitting the first four strings with the back of the fingernails, dropping the thumb onto the fifth string, which it will then pluck, creating a drone effect. Scruggs style, on the other hand, is named after Earl Scruggs, who developed the effective three-finger picking technique.
They're mutually exclusive.
Have you people ever actually enjoyed what music is about? The idea that the phrase, was it the claw of the backside of a hammer? That should be applied to music. Music is about transcendence for me. It's about reaching a higher level. This is absolutely barbaric.
He continues, while many pioneer banjo players have blended different styles together, it remains that clawhammer and the three-finger scrug style are wildly opposed in terms of hardware and technique. The community is incredibly divided over it, and scrug style players often shun clawhammer players. Please find attached a recording of an attempt at clawhammer version of your email jingle. So we'll use that later on for the email jingle.
Yeah,
from Zabby. Okay. But yeah, it boiled down.
Yeah,
you made a huge mistake, Mike.
My ignorance has been exposed. Yes, I'm sorry. I am banjo ignorant. I've been banjo ambitious. I think I rewarded myself after completing a series of exams by buying myself a proper 5-string banjo and a Teach Yourself Banjo book and deciding that I would master it within the year.
Mm.
And
did you get more than 7% through that book?
Did not get more than 7% through that book. It's probably 8% is where they explain the difference between the two techniques. So I am banjo. I'm wholly banjo ignorant. I apologize, Xavier, and I apologize to the banjo community at large. Bollocking bonanza, fully accepted.
Bollocking accepted.
Mike, what's the incentive to get, like at the end of this process, I'll be able to play the banjo?
Yeah.
What will that do?
Yeah, keep talking.
How will that help you or anyone else? What's the upside of that?
To then understand life, the universe and everything through the medium of the banjo.
Okay.
An enlightenment of sort, a 5-string enlightenment.
The hardest bit about learning the banjo is when you have to build the large wooden porch at the front of your house, isn't it? That's the
Yeah.
Which is always, that's the first 3% of the book.
You can get really bad porch calluses. You can see them, can't you, on experienced players, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't quite manage the full. I managed a stoop. That's about as far as I could get. Yeah.
And obviously, the metalwork needed to create that swinging sofa thing. That's quite a lot of welding and hard metalwork. You've got.
And then trying to change our residential, quite built up residential street into a kind of mud track that comes off a swamp.
Yeah, yeah. That's difficult.
From which you can't see any other houses or buildings, or certainly any emergency services. And to then cut off any sort of phone lines or mobile phone contact from the area. I was exhausted.
And you're just, what are the chances that you will get attacked by a crocodile?
Well, that's it.
It's not high enough, is it?
It's a pipe dream.
It's a pipe dream. Because what you really want, ideally, is a dog. What you need is a dog and a crocodile, where the dog is small enough and the crocodile's big enough for either of them to eat each other in a pitched street battle. I don't know.
To the tune of Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Exactly, mate.
Anyway, the reason why we started talking about this was because for some reason, and I can't remember what it was, I started talking about the podcast charts. Oh, because Mike was talking about the podcast, The Very British Cult.
But is that podcast? I really enjoyed it, and it's brilliant, but it sort of makes the point that there's a cult on your street. There's a cult around the corner. You know, you might be walking past someone who's in a cult. And I really enjoyed it, and it was fascinating. Yeah. But the cults that people get really excited about are the cults that are quite hard to get up and running in Britain on the whole.
Like the ones that have got a tank.
Yeah, there's a tank, there's military-level hardware, and you are in the middle of a massive... You're in
compound.
A prairie so big you can invent your own town, for example, or a forest. We don't really have the space, do we?
No, you're right.
We could manage an island cult, maybe a sort of tiny Hebridean island. But again, I mean, the habitable ones, there's already some people on there that might have something to say about it.
The National Trust are already there, aren't they?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
The ultimate cult.
The ultimate cult.
Well, they are a cult in a way, aren't they? Because they try and entice you in with lemon drizzle cakes, National Trust teas. That's the kind of recruitment thing, isn't it? Is the moistness of a lemon drizzle cake in a National Trust tea room.
Yeah. You don't have one lemon drizzle and never return.
No.
That's you locked in. Before you know it, you're subscribing. You're signing up family members as gifts.
Yeah.
That's what happened to me this year. I got signed up as a gift.
Did you? To the National Trust?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or recruited, as they say.
And pretty soon, Ben, you'll find yourself, you'll look in the mirror one day and you'll realise, I'm looking at myself in the grey, dusty mirror of a large, stately home. I'm in the pantry of an old British stately home. I stand here for about 8 hours a day, occasionally fielding questions about where the toilets are.
Stopping children touching the harpsichord.
Don't go past the rope!
And occasionally telling people about the wonders
of crenellation.
Of crenellation in the 17th century pantry setting.
That's what my tell-all after the cult book would be called. It'd be called Beyond the Rope.
Yeah.
Leaving the National Trust. My life behind the rope. So yeah, Mike, that podcast did make an interesting point where they spoke to somebody from like a cult group, NGO
yeah.
type thing. And they said the big thing is that even though we think of them as being these kind of wild and loony things, they are everywhere. And there's one in your town and there's one in your neighborhood. And that was the most interesting bit for me. I just thought, oh, that made me really like,
it's quite chilling
and look around, you know?
I thought it was very good, that thing of a British cult. Although there was one thing about it, though, which I thought I didn't understand, which is they never said anything about it that made it very British. I don't think it was very British. And the head of the cult was South African.
Good point.
Like, there was literally nothing in that cult that was very British. Like, what was...
Some of the contributors were British.
It happened in Britain.
It happened in Britain. But I think there wasn't, like, an element of, like, I don't know, what would be a very British cult?
Are they saying, was it because there wasn't a great deal of fuss made about it?
Well, they made it.
There wasn't a gun-toting cult. They weren't burning effigies.
I'm sorry, there was nothing very British about it. I'm sorry.
It was quite suburban.
Yeah, but it was a South African guy who was conning people, telling them that he could make them a lot of money through investments and stuff, right?
Classically British. And what's more British than
Tell
that?
Tell me a more British tale, Henry.
You know, sorry, that cult, in a very British cult.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what was it again? I forgot. What was he actually offering? Like, how did it work?
It was supposed to be like a sort of self-help.
Oh, that was it, yeah.
Type thing. And you'd pay in and you'd get Zoom tutorials about how to be the best you can be and all that kind of thing. Achieve your dreams, yeah. 1 year plans, 5 year plans. Give us a bit more dosh, and we'll give you even more secrets about how to invest. But a lot of the time, it was invest in Lighthouse, invest in this, invest in that,
and then you have to go and live in a house people spending with some other people,
yeah.
And then just sit on Zoom listening to him talking to you all day,
yeah.
And that's it.
And if you've got senior enough, then you might spend a bit of time zooming other people.
Oh, to get them. You know what? I'm just remembering something which happened during that period to me, which feels like it's It's me trying to crowbar in doing an accent, but it's not actually.
I'm pleased you said that because it doesn't feel like that now.
It was around about the time I was listening to that when I started being haunted by the ghost of Sean Connery. So it was around about the time I was listening to that cult, that show about very British cult, about the South African man who ran a cult in Britain, because there was lots of bits of him talking. He was saying things like, it's not about profit, it's about love. You put yourself into the business and you're not about greed. It's about, and then the benefits will come to you. Yes? Was it that kind of thing?
Yeah.
I was a triple millionaire by the time I was 4 years old. Yeah. Do you understand? I did all the usual business things and I went and I realised what I was...
Yeah.
Yeah. 11 years old, I had an epiphany, and I realized this is not the way to manage a business.
Now, listen, I was a big deal back.
It's about community. Do you understand? Community. Are you listening? Community. Listen to me.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff about his business past in South Africa, wasn't it? I was a big hitter. I was in the top rooms. I was, if there was a room with business happening in it, and I wasn't in it, and that room might as well not have had, certainly not have had me in it, or might as well not have been a room that was...
By the way, accent-wise, I'm staying above the fray.
What was... So I am, so he'd be like, yeah, I was a corporate finance, I was there, I was the top man, people would come to me for advice, and then they sent a journalist over to investigate his actual financial past, and it was like, we think he may have sold one peach. We're not sure. He may have just handed someone a peach. But we know that the peach changed hands. But no, it was around about that time I was dealing with a South African estate agent, and it just meant that everything he said, I couldn't believe anything he said, because he'd be like, "Yes, I know. We think the market is quite a good time to to sell at the moment," or he'd be saying that, and I'd be like, "Get out of my head!"
And you're bashing his pockets in case there's a peach in there.
I was like, "Get out of my head! You, I'm not going. I'm not playing your game." it really did affect how I viewed him. Okay, here's the thing. During there was a period about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe, was it, where everything on TV was cults. Everyone was obsessed with cults. It was almost like we'd all suddenly become members of because we were all saying the same thing. We were all preaching from the same hymn sheets. Every night we'd go home, we'd be like, "Oh, I'm going to watch another thing about a cult." Almost as if, yeah, we were part of a cult. No, but because do you remember there was that period where everything was about cults? Everyone was like,
I've got to say, I don't remember this particularly. No, I'm not. This isn't ringing any bells with me. Yeah,
there was a thing where the water cooler conversation was like, "Have you watched that? It's cult show." Yes, brilliant. But have you heard about this other cult show? It's even better. Oh, brilliant!
You're right. There was a Netflix period where Netflix decided
Wild Country.
Yeah, that was the one.
Wild Country or just Wild Country?
I think it was Double Wild.
That was brilliant. But one thing that came up watching that, which is a conversation people quite often have around cults, is, do you think you would
start a cult and go to war with the FBI? And the answer is yes.
The answer is, where do I sign?
Well, would I join a cult?
Yeah.
The thing is, everyone thinks the answer is no, right? But then...
And by the way, just quickly, while we're on this topic, Three Bean Salad has a Patreon. Three tiers. We've divided it. We've done all the classic cult things, haven't it? It's a hierarchical system.
And then there's a new tier called the Bean Rapture.
Right, Bean Rapture. Now that is where
you sign over the deeds to your house.
Yeah.
Join us in the compound.
Your uncle's house. You can join us in the compound when the day comes. We'll give you a pre-alert 24 hours beforehand.
As long as you're holding a can of beans at the crucial moment when the earth is destroyed by spurbs, it'll be into a huge vortex. And then obviously when Beanmageddon happens, if you're within the compound...
And we're transported to the final bean in the sky.
That's right. We'll be transported up to the bean-shaped spaceship. But... that spaceship is not cheap to run, which is why...
Well, we all know about fuel costs. Getting the AC running on that thing is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, because...
it's coal-powered, and that's getting harder and harder to come by.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that heat, the coal power produces such excess heat that we need even more aircon, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to keep podcasting after the end of planet Earth, that is the plan, isn't it, that we keep podcasting.
Going beyond recorded time.
That's right.
Yes.
Hoping to crack into that top 10 iTunes comedy chart. You know, if for example, Peter Crouch is incinerated,
yeah,
would that necessarily be a bad thing, just chart-wise?
Ben, really sorry, but the latest data suggests that even though the whole of the Earth has ceased to exist for the last 20 years, Three Bean Salad is still behind Shagged, Married, Annoyed. We can't explain it. It's a mystery. But they're still getting a much bigger hit every week.
And they're still managing to do an arena tour somehow. I'm not sure. Because everything is now ash, so I don't know how that's working, but good luck to them.
Yeah, but so that's why, yeah, Bean Rapture members, look, the fact is, it's not a cult, is it? I mean, that's the truth.
It's your last chance to live.
We're just trying to save your life. If you want to call that a cult, then be our guest. But but in the meantime, it's all about nurturing the beans
and cutting ties with your family.
Cutting ties with your family. Anyone that, for example, doesn't like the beans. If people, for example, say things,
naysayers. Say nay to naysayers. So there's the naysaying program.
Yeah.
That's important. That's compulsory.
It's compulsory. But if there are people around you, you might find they're toxic, what we call toxic presences. That's people who do things like tell you that you'd be better off listening to the rest of politics or other podcasts like that. But by all means, come to one of our meetings. It's in a way, it's a kind of insurance, which is the best thing that could happen. And we still have a bit of this, is the world doesn't explode.
But it is
on the Ides of Bean. in the year 2027. But it is, as you say, it is going to. But let's put it this way: it's like insurance, isn't it? You hope that the plane's not going to crash, but it is going to crash in this case. So you want to be insured, don't you?
I don't think being insured in a plane crash makes much difference at the end of the day. If I was in a plane that was going down, I wouldn't be thinking, thank God I got my travel insurance sorted.
No.
Thanks to the post office for that.
What you'd be doing is going and seeing finally what happens in those little metal tray things they've got at the back. That's what you'd be like.
No one can stop me now.
I'm going to find it out. Do they slot the meal, slot through the tray to the metal? Do they slot out the meal? What happens back there? I will take this knowledge to my dad. It's not payment. Okay, so the thing is, you don't pay us to be part of the 3B
community. Oh, no, it's still your money. Well, it'll be ready for you in the...
Think of it as an investment.
In the bean ship.
But the bean ship, because the
bean
ship...
I should say, which has the engine of a Hyundai i10.
That's right.
Several.
Adapted for coal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your money is held simply in an account with Omnibank, which is benevolent bank.
Yeah. It's very much on side, isn't it? We've got members of the community very, very high up in Omnibank.
And yes, some of that will be invested in their private military contractor program that they've got running at the moment, but they need protection too, don't they?
Can't put a price on peace of mind, which is why we haven't. You will never be sold how much of your money we're taking. You know that lovely, warm, relaxing feeling you get when you go into a restaurant and you see there's no prices on the menu? That's what we can offer you. And also, we're trying to really move now to a system, isn't it? We're not paying, because it's not a product, is it? We're not a product. We are a solution. So the way we think of it is, it's not so much you giving us money as us giving you financial space.
Space to think.
Space to relax and breathe.
And be unburdened by the weight of your money.
You know, some people's attitude is like, I can't believe these idiots, how they fall for this stuff. Because, you know, they'll have like weird haircuts and they don't talk to their families anymore and they're expecting to travel to space and things. But enough about the world's tech billionaires.
Time to use that new satire jingle.
Yes, please.
Hello.
Hi, Henry. I'm just editing the podcast and I've got a question for you.
Okay.
It's the first time ever that in the edit I can use one of two jingles and both seem equally apt.
Oh my god.
So what happens is you say the thing about these cults is you've got these people with weird hair and they leave their family and they want to go to space, and then you say, anyway, enough about the world's tech billionaires.
Great stuff, isn't it? Just such a privilege to work with, isn't it? What?
So obviously, yeah. The jingles that we could use are the old switcheroo, because that's it's a classic switcheroo joke.
Oh, fuck.
But it's also...
satire.
Satirical, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't suppose you fancy doing any satire-a-roo jingle.
That's not a bad idea.
I mean, is there a way of doing it?
Leave it with me, Henry.
Okay.
All right.
It couldn't be a pair of saber hands. Yeah,
bye
then.
Bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the old
Satire-a-roo.
Okay, yes, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you're saying that. What? Hang on, I thought you were trying to say that. Oh, he's gone the other... What? Oh, he's gone the other way around. He means that... Oh, that's what he meant. What? So, what he said before wasn't actually... Now he's gone the other way around with it. Oh, God!
It's the old
Satire-a-roo.
But My attitude to myself is I think I could definitely be conned to and suckered into signing up for a cult. I think I could. I think I've got it. In fact, I basically think anyone could. That's my view on it.
I think though most people, I think, in their life at some point have felt the cult jinglings, but kind of related to something else. So like sometimes someone will really get into exercise to the extent where it slightly feels like they're getting into a cult. Do you know what I mean? Like they'll really get into...
They can't talk about anything else.
Yeah, exactly. And they're just really into CrossFit or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And I think when you meet those people, I think that happens to quite a lot of people and it's quite normal. You go, oh, that's what it is. It's not that far away from like normal stuff.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, can I say, I've just realized something, Ben.
Yeah.
This week, I have, in a way, I hadn't thought of it till now, joined a cult. Because I now subscribe.
He's holding up a Pret coffee cup.
To Pret-a-Manger.
You've broken from the shackles of Costa.
But not that. It's not just that I broke from the Costa shackles. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying. I subscribe to Pret-a-Manger.
What do you mean?
I'm now streaming coffee. I pay a monthly subscription to Pret-a-Manger. And I have all the coffee I can drink, thank you.
Wow.
Do you understand? Do you know about that?
No.
But essentially, I have subscribed to a cult and a form of Pret. And the idea that, you know, one day I'll be in a croissant-shaped spaceship in the sky. And you'll all be screwed.
Two questions. How many coffees do you have to drink a month
for it to be making your
money back?
To be making a profit, as it were. So, okay, I can certainly... I've already got a sense of your attitude to any sort of buffet. Eat all you can. I'm going to keep eating. I don't care if I'm being sick at the same time. I'm going to keep eating spring rolls and Peking duck pancakes until this makes financial sense.
Well, I've talked before about how if you get the Boots Meal Deal, the best money back way of doing that is buying a tin of car mints.
Yeah. Which is why you make car mints bolognese now, don't you?
So how many coffees do you reckon on average?
So I haven't done the maths. It's 30 quid a month.
Oh, that's quite a lot.
The other thing is they got me with the first month is half price, classic subscription model. It's what we all do with our phone contracts. They suck you in with a nice deal. They also said, so I get, they get you in. They tempt you in with this idea that it's five drinks a day, right? But five coffees a day is a dangerous amount of coffee.
That's beyond what most people.
Yeah, four kills you, so you're dead on four. So they've made it one more than death. So
five. You need an assistant to get the fifth one down. Exactly. You're just making a point.
Yeah. So it's five a day. What I found is, once you're subscribing, it is a bit like being a member of a cult, because all I can think about now is Pret, and if I'm getting my money's, I need to have more Prets. I need to have more. I need
how
to be
far
consuming
away
Prets.
Where's the nearest Pret?
It's
like a beacon calling out to you all the time.
Also, a bit like a cult. I have cut off my previous. In that I won't go to a Costa now. I've cut off my previous family, and it was like a family. A family of indifferent sort of short-term contract workers who never said hello to me or remembered me, but it was still still a family.
Well, families are complex, aren't they?
Families are complex.
What would happen if you walked into a Costa now? Would they just spit at you?
Get out.
You have the mark of Pret on you. I can smell it on you.
Or would they lock the doors behind you and try and save you?
Try and save me?
I would never go. Basically, it would never happen. I would never go into a Costa now because, essentially, I now it's a complete waste. I'm throwing away double the money. If I buy a coffee in Costa, I'm throwing away double the money because I've got good coffee I've paid for elsewhere. There's no point me buying coffee here when I'm already paying. I don't want to pay Peter and Paul. I just want a coffee. You know what I'm saying?
And that mocker's just going to taste of betrayal, isn't it?
Also, Pret have kind of got you on the hook for now you're going in there five times a day.
Yeah.
You're going to be buying the breakfast porridge.
Yeah.
The posh cheddar sandwich at lunchtime.
Yeah.
You might as well.
Can I say yes, except yes to breakfast porridge, but breakfast porridge in the sense of the new Pret bacon and egg roll, which I've eaten every day, I think, since I joined, since I became a subscriber.
And that's not included in the subscription either.
No, you get 10% off, which sort of isn't... But so what's happening is I'm drinking so much coffee. That was why I was feeling unwell at the beginning of the podcast. I had to open the window. It was partly because I've had two, this is my second Pret coffee of the day that I'm drinking now. Also, last week during the hot spell, I was drinking so many of the iced oat milk latte. So iced oat milk latte, that's the kind of, that's the drink of the summer, by the way.
Okay.
You know, there's a song of the summer. The drink of the summer is what all the cool people in London are drinking is oat milk iced latte. But I was drinking so many oat milk iced lattes, I was starting to feel sick. And I've had to then just completely stop drinking them. And because I was drinking three a day, and I started to kind of feel this sickly kind of brown... sweet, sickly, there's all this brown liquid. I had this sense of all this brown.
You probably sort of stank of baby sick.
I would have stank of,
you know, sort of milky sweet.
Had a really baby sick vibe to it. So it was that sickly, milky, claggy, sweet, sweet brown, too much brown, sweet stuff in me, you know, like nutty, hazelnutty, chocolatey brown, all that kind of those things. And I started to feel sick with it.
And like a baby, you would throw your arms around someone and just puke down their back, wouldn't you?
Just puke down their back, yeah. And also, I've been going to Pret so much that, so for example, today, something that's never happened to me in my life, I was the first customer in a Pret at about 6:30 this morning. 6:30 a.m.
You've got to start soon. They've got you by the balls, Henry.
You've got to start hitting those coffees early, ASAP.
Oh, Henry. We need to stage an intervention of some sort.
So I was the first person in the Pret, and that meant that I got to see...
You were the special boy.
I was the special boy. I got to break through the pastry carapace over the door. I got to break the crust, the morning crust. I broke through. It was me. I got to see things I've never seen. So they were laying out the sandwiches. And... and also because it was so early, I got to glimpse through a bit of the Pret I've never seen, which is I got to see into the kind of kitchen bit, which you don't normally see. I got, because they were just sort of setting things up, and it wasn't what I expected to see at all.
Were you expecting sort of rows and rows of French boulangers?
I was expecting like a busy French brasserie kitchen.
Rustic wooden benches, hams aging, hanging from the ceiling, pheasants.
Rather than the back of a lorry spewing its contents into a warehouse room.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think put into a giant microwave.
It was a kind of metal, it was just a very metal. Yeah, it was actually, weirdly, it was a bit like that the metal bit, those trays at the back of a plane. It was like a sort of metal unit with just kind of trays of paint, sort of trays of dough. Trays of differently shaped dough, trays of another shape of dough. It was very like mechanized. It was just trays of dough going in, trays of croissants going out. It wasn't, Ben, as you say, like an apple-cheeked boy munching the top of a croissant while having his hair tousled by a
flower-covered wench.
A flower-covered wench, in her turn, having her ear nuzzled by a member of the French Resistance.
on the back of a shy horse.
On the back of a shy horse. The shy horse, of course, was a double agent, and all of those people ended up being handed over to the official authorities.
And that's why you've got to be so careful.
You've got to be so careful.
When subscribing to a cult.
Time to read your emails, and instead of using the usual email jingle, we've had a version of it sent in by Xavier, who earlier dealt out to Mike the Banjo Bollock Bonanza, which Mike humbly, I would say, accepted.
Thank you for keeping my feet on the ground, Xavier.
Well, as well as sending us the Bollock Bonanza, he also writes, please find attached a dreadful recording of an attempt at a Clawhammer version of your email jingle using my trusty old 1970s Framus long neck banjo in standard F tuning.
Lovely. Thank you. So we'll be edified as well.
Let's give it a listen.
When you send an email, you ask your friends to the postmasters that came before. Hello, postmaster, anything for me? Just some old shit. When you send an email, the smoke rises progress.
Nice.
Very nice.
Lovely.
Enjoyed that.
There's a weird thing, isn't there, with that jingle where obviously the genre in which I wrote it, you'd describe as, I don't know.
Bossa Nova?
Bossa Nova Future Clash.
Ben, I'd love to see the documentary one day about how you wrote the jingles. And hope, like all music documentaries, it'll feature you sitting by a piano quite casually. Just with a finger, just tapping a key and talking about how it came to you. And you know that way people do, because what they like to do is in music documentaries, they'll go, what came to you first was just two notes. And then I started to feel it was more like, then they show off doing it really beautifully. Will you do that, Ben?
Yes.
And then it cuts to a talking head with Niles Rogers. You've got to have Niles Rogers. Is that what he's called?
I think he's called Nile Rogers, isn't he?
I think he's called Nile Roger.
I always get the I always get the singularity or plurality of names wrong. That's not. I can't do anything about that, Mike.
It's Nile Rogers.
It's
Nile Rogers.
Nile Rogers.
It's about time, actually, that we publicly acknowledge that Nile Rogers is writing one of the
singles. Yeah. And of course, Bernie Taupin writes the words to them, doesn't he?
He does.
I'm not sure Taupin. I know who Bernie Taupin is.
He writes all the words for Elton John.
Ah, of course.
And I think it's pronounced Taupin.
Okay. Bernie Taupin.
Bernie's Taupin.
Bernie's Taupin.
It's an amazing thing that all of Elton John's, or 90% of Elton John's lyrics are written by Bernie's Taupin, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the fact that they're written by a Taupin will explain some of the lyrics not making a huge amount of sense. And I suppose, or at least Crocodile Rock. I suppose as a Terrapin, crocodiles are something you think about. Certainly you worry about them.
Michael from London writes, Dear Beans, the other day I was listening to Three Bean Salad on a train heading into Waterloo. In the episode, Henry says the word narwhal a few times. However, his pronunciation of nachwhal...
narwhal?
Yeah.
Made me chuckle quite a bit.
Gnarwal. Gnarwal. Yeah.
I started to say nachwal out loud, which brought me immense joy.
Good.
After a few seconds of genuine fun, I noticed a mother move her child to another set of doors away from me while saying out loud, let's just head this way, dear. I can only imagine that saying nachwal out loud out of the blue caused a fair amount of concern / distress for a young parent. I'll be careful not to say it again on any more trains. Best, Michael from London.
You lean into it, Michael. If that's what gets you through the commute, you go for it.
Paul emails, Dear Beans, on holiday in the Lake District this week, I curled up in a puddle of sunshine on a sofa. Oh, that sounds nice. To listen to the latest episode of Three Bean Salad. Soon I was overcome by drowsiness.
It has been known to have that effect in the past. Enhanced somewhat by the puddle of sunshine, I'll say.
Not due to the soporific nature of the podcast.
Oh.
But rather because I had done a long walk in the morning, drunk a couple of pints at lunchtime, because I'm a middle-aged man. Just as Mistress Sleep was about to fully embrace me in her loving arms, I was wrenched from my slumbers by what sounded like someone shouting my name to the tune of Eye of the Tiger. Had I been dreaming? I rewound the pod again, listened again, and confirmed that Henry was not the only one to think that when Ben shouted lens, length, lens, he actually shouted lens, lens, lens. Kind regards, Paul Lenz.
Oh, that's an absolutely superb email. I wonder, we can ask Paul Lenz, if he's an optician, get back in touch. If not, just simply don't reply.
Or a photographer.
Or a photographer. Because you do get people, don't you, have the surname that's quite relevant to the job they do.
It's called nominative determinism.
Yeah.
So, for example, I am a partridge hunter.
Yeah.
And you pack the partridges for sale.
That's right.
For the purposes of Wozniacking.
Which is trying to go on a date with Caroline Wozniacki.
Who's Caroline Wozniacki?
Is she a tennis player? I may have made up her first name. Yes, so other examples of... I know some good examples of nominative determinism. One is Boris Johnson, because he thought with his Johnson when he was making his policies.
Oh, more satire. Lovely. Yeah.
Ooh, someone's at the door. I think it's the satire, please. Hang on.
Oh, my God, I'm just... oh, it's terrible. I'm reading a terrible thing on BBC News. It's breaking news. The country's gone to Amber Alert because a truth bomb has gone off in London. Hang on, Ben hasn't come back, has it?
No, he has left, yeah. Yeah, he's gone.
Is that... Is that what Ben says now? He gets a bit embarrassed when he has to go to the toilet. He says, oh, it's a satire place and goes away for 10 to 15 minutes. Now, what are some other good ones? You sometimes... What's funny is on the news when they're interviewing someone... And they have to not make a joke of it because they're talking about the news. So they'll be like, and now we turn over to our munitions expert, Peter Handgun. And then they just have to keep talking and not make a joke of it. Do you know what I mean?
Because Peter's been through it.
He's been through it.
Countless times.
Yeah. The hell is going on? Oh, Ben had a genuine people at the door.
Yeah, yeah.
Here he is.
Hello.
Hi, Ben.
I'm knackered now after running up the stairs. 2 seconds.
Have you just been to the toilet?
No.
Where have you been?
The doorbell.
Oh, it did actually go?
Yeah.
Hang on. So, have you got an upstairs toilet?
I didn't go to the toilet. But I have got an upstairs toilet, yes.
Yeah, that was I was a double bluff. I was testing. So you just popped the door, signed for a package, went to the toilet and came down, is that right? You say we delivered a toilet to you?
Upstairs.
Was it someone at the door?
Yes.
So hang on, see, are you in a basement right now, does that mean?
No, I'm upstairs.
Yeah, then you
ran downstairs.
Oh, then you ran upstairs. Oh, for some reason I thought you'd run upstairs, then downstairs, which meant either you're in a basement or your front door is accessed by some sort of crane.
But what's that got to do with where my toilet might be?
All great questions.
Thank you to everyone who signed up to our Patreon.
Thank you.
We've got the various tiers. The top tier, of course, is the...
The Rapture tier, yeah.
The Rapture tier, yeah. And thanks to everyone who signed up at that tier. Of course, at other tiers lower down, you get ad-free episodes, you get our monthly bonus episode. And at the Sean Bean tier, you, of course, get a shout-out from Mike from the Sean Bean Lounge. And that's where you were last night, wasn't it, Mike?
Sure was, old buddy.
And it was a bit of... It was one of those sort of health and safety gone mad moments yesterday, wasn't it? Because, of course, it was the emergency lacquer work training.
It was. Thank you, Henry. And here's my report.
There was a three-line whip at the Sean Bean Lounge last night for emergency lacquer work training. The emergency lacquer work inquiry, commissioned by JP with the blessing of Sean Bean and conducted by the Emergency Lacquer Work Committee, chaired by Jessica Trushell, had its first draft report leaked by Kai Pritchard as a favour to Michael, who'd heard from Tetov that he'd been named in it by Alec Crawford as the whistleblower reported upon by Ruth Boyd in the Bean Lounge Gazette, who'd claimed that Sean Bean hasn't worn trousers for 14 years and instead has been having his legs varnished with a chino finish by Paul Rowntree. That turned out to be unfounded, but Jamie Spears, the only person who could be bothered to read the report past the first three lines, noted that no provision had been made for emergency lacquer work in the event of a lacquer emergency in the Bean Lounge since 1842. Roland Young ran this up the flagpole upon which Sean Bean was sitting, lacquering the pole on his descent to be on the safe side, and Sean Bean declared that a state of lacquer-based preparedness was that evening's primary objective. The furnishings being perfect, it was decided that training should be conducted upon Sean Bean loungers who Mooley Zero felt were in need of a more glossy lustre. Brendan Roberts was sanded down by Becky I. Lucas Jasper with fine grain paper, while Alexander Penny had his holes filled in with grain filler and bits of Colin Ruddock. Brittany's homemade nitrocellulose lacquer was first applied by spray can onto Bryce Ferguson, but the can was too far away and Bryce began to dimple. An adorable yet flawed result. Eleanor Lucas went in too close on Michael Morgan, causing Chris Kylar to nickname Michael the Bean Lounge Tiger, which was misunderstood by Justin Hallsberg, who declared the spot Michael was standing on to be a protected nature reserve, around which Victoria Sims promptly built a 12-foot-high anti-poacher fence, which was patchily lacquered by Paul Olchevy before being sandblasted and resealed by Cameron Franklin before being lacquered expertly by Rebecca Barton. Paranew Andrew ticked off a lifelong ambition by opening a Tiger Safari tour company, whose first customer, David Cartledge, ignored the advice about keeping limbs inside the vehicle and was promptly dragged off and presumably eaten. Thanks all.
That's the pod. And to play us out, a version of our theme tune sent in by Chris in Bremen. Hello Beans, please find attached my submission for your theme tune, Played on My Face. I've not heard it yet, so I don't know what that means.
Great. Thank you for that. And thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye.